All rise. The judges of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Morning, everybody. Here today to take up oral argument in case of United States versus Spielman. Are both sides prepared to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
It's my understanding that you wish to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. Is that correct? Very well. Government? Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Spinner, please proceed.
And I do want to be clear, since we have another spectators here, to the extent that I talk about civilian defense counsel at trial, I did not defend this case at trial. I only served as the appellate defense counsel. We have two issues that the court granted a oral argument on, and only two issues which we raised in this case. The first is factual and legal sufficiency of the evidence. The second, there has to be reported to trial counsel and improper prejudicial arguments during finance may disparage defense counsel and accused in any case of his own beliefs and opinions as it proceeds. Because of the limitations of time, which stands for oral argument, my focus is going to be on the second issue. I primarily will rely on a brief for the factual insufficiency of the evidence. In a way, they're actually connected, because it is the defense position that through the trial counsel's arguments, he in effect was reflecting attention from the facts of the case and relying on disparagement of defense counsel, disparagement of the accused, and interjecting his own personal beliefs in the case. And the primary appellate decision that we're relying on for our position is United States versus Fletcher, which is cited in our brief multiple points, 62 NJ 175, which was originally an Air Force case and was decided by CAF in 2005. In this case, it really lays out what the law is with respect to, first of all, plain error. And we acknowledge up front that we are claiming plain error in this case. The defense did not make objections to any objections to the whole trial, quite frankly. With respect to this issue, the Spielman case is somewhat distinguishable from Fletcher, because in Fletcher there were some objections, but in other parts of Fletcher there were no objections. And so at some points in Fletcher, the court applied the plain error and then tested whether it rose to level plain error, and found that it did. And whereas that standard was not applied where there were in fact objections made. Because there were no objections made, and because the trial judge did not sponte inject himself in the proceeding to provide any instruction or caution trial counsel, we don't really have a curative instruction situation, because there was no objection and there was no attempt then by the judge to instruct.
Isn't the lack of objection normally an indication of lack of prejudice?
It is a factor that the court must consider, the fact that there was no objection. But as in Fletcher, the court found plain error when there was no objection in that case. Now, there were different kinds of cases. Fletcher was a drug case, and this is a sexual assault case. But at least that did not keep CAF from reversing in Fletcher.
Do you assert that the arguments by trial counsel in this case rose to the same level of impropriety as those in Fletcher?
I certainly anticipated you would ask that question. I would say not to the same level as in Fletcher. But there are some aspects of this case that really distinguish it from Fletcher and that I think work against the government. In that regard, we're really going to focus on the testimony of Captain Fox. If you recall, the government, and this goes beyond what trial counsel said in his closing argument, it really goes to the foundation of what the trial counsel said in his closing argument, and his disparagement of counsel, as well as disparagement of the accused. The civilian defense counsel, in this case, at the Article 32 hearing, had his client make an unsworn statement, and so because it was unsworn, there was no cross-examination. But the prosecutor in Allen's case called Captain Fox, who was one of the government representatives and also the chief of military justice, to testify as to what Lieutenant Spillman said in his unsworn statement at the Article 32 hearing. And of course, this goes to one of my pet peeves about Air Force and Air Force Article 32 hearings. Now that I've practiced in the Navy and Army courts and the Defense Council, the Civilian Defense Council, the former Army chief, in Army and Navy cases, they record Article 32 hearings routinely, if not always. In the Air Force, there's always this battle between the staff judge advocate, it appears, and defense attorneys in many cases, as to whether or not an Article 32 hearing would be recorded. And so there's no recording of what Lieutenant Spillman said at the Article 32 hearing. Now, the trial counsel could have called the Article 32 investigating officer to testify as to what Lieutenant Spillman said, but instead, and I don't know why he didn't, I'm not sure how much it matters, except that you had basically a prosecutor, a chief of military justice, a government representative from the Article 32 hearing is now testifying as to what Lieutenant Spillman said in the absence of any verbatim record of what Lieutenant Spillman said.
Counsel, doesn't that just go to the weight of the evidence and not, how is that tied into disparaging defense counsel?
And I'm just going to ignore that. There's a point where there's a recess at the Article 32 hearing where the trial counsel makes a big deal out of the fact that it was a 10-minute recess, and the defense counsel, both defense counsel and the client, I guess took 20 minutes. And and even at one point, Captain Fox says, myself and my co-government representative, we were ready to go at the end of 10 minutes. Well, how is that relevant to anything other than supporting this argument the trial counsel had that the defense counsel was using this extra time to create a defense or to fabricate a defense? And the trial counsel uses the term fabricating evidence two times in his closing argument. So it's not so much, I believe that there is bias when you have a prosecutor, using a prosecutor to get facts like this before the court, and then to argue that this is fabricated evidence, which goes essentially to what Fletcher talks about. So in my mind, it's not just the weight of the evidence, it's it's the motivation of the senior trial counsel who prosecuted this case to present this and to make an issue of it.
To be clear, you're not arguing, that the military judge erred in allowing Captain Fox's testimony. You're simply arguing that that testimony combined with trial counsel's argument created some sort of disparaging attitude toward the defense counsel.
Let me ask you too, sir. In a case that turns, or could be argued to turn in great measure, on the member's assessment of the credibility of witnesses with competing stories, is the problem here that the prosecutor said this guy's fabricating a story, or is it the fact that he said the guy and his lawyer fabricated a story? And is there a distinction?
It's certainly, and his lawyer, because he refers multiple times to the lawyer by name. And it's a combination of that. But also he basically calls Lieutenant Spillman a liar. And so,
Is that in itself objectionable?
I believe it is, Your Honor, based on Fletcher and what Fletcher said. But going back to the Article 32, part of the other problem has to do with the phone records. And it's clear that everyone in the Article 32 was confused about how to interpret the times of the phone calls at the Article 32 hearing.
Counsel, would you agree, I'm going to go back to your earlier point, would you agree, though, that trial counsel is allowed to comment on the believability of an accused testimony?
I believe that he can comment on the credibility of any witness, including the accused, in a proceeding. It's when it goes beyond just commenting on the credibility to calling him an out-and-out liar, saying that he fabricated this defense, working with his defense counsel. I think that's where the line is crossed. And then, at a couple of points, in his closing argument, he puts the weight of the United States government behind his position. And so it's sort of a building block, I guess. At first you have, well, okay, you're challenging the credibility of the accused, but then you're saying, he's a liar. And I'll just give you some pages from the closing argument that I think are telling. On page 1039 of the record, he says, the incredible candidness there on the court, at least by my perception. In other words, he's bringing his own credibility, his belief, as to the extent of the case in play. Then he says, your story is also consistent. There's some reference to you not claiming this is your story, you're claiming your 10 stories. And then he says, false, false, false. Which is tantamount to saying, why, why? Fabrication. And then he goes on down on page 1039 and continues. Isn't it telling members? And then he makes a statement, and at the end of the statement he says, I think it is. I mean, this trial counsel is clearly staking his own credibility and reputation on what he believes the evidence says and what it is. At one point, on page 1038, the page in front of that, he's talking about the defense positions, and he says, so it's not the first big lie that was promised. And clearly, he's now talking about defense counsel, because it was the defense counsel who made the opening statement, not Lieutenant Spielman. And so he's referencing that, and he's basically saying the defense counsel is a liar.
Counsel, doesn't that go to the invited reply doctrine in terms of the defense counsel makes promises during opening statement? I read that as to be the defense counsel promised that there would be a lie by the complaining witness and that trial counsel was arguing that the evidence in the record did not support that conclusion. Not that the defense counsel was a liar, but that defense counsel's promise of showing that the victim was a liar was unfulfilled.
Right. I mean, it certainly is an interesting use of lie in conjunction with the defense counsel and the promise they made. So I think it can be interpreted both ways, whether you're saying that they said the defense failed this promise to prove that she was lying. So it's putting the words in the defense counsel's mouth and then saying he didn't do it. So in effect, the defense counsel is lying. And I think the challenge is...
But counsel, I'm going to challenge you there. He didn't say... Defense counsel is a liar, correct?
I agree with that. But he does, with respect to the use of the term fabrication that he uses twice in his argument, it does come back to what I was going to say earlier about the there was confusion at the Article 32 hearing about the phone records. And so Lieutenant Spielman testified that he woke up and there was a text message and then he made a phone call. And subsequently, as the case came to trial, it came out that he had backwards. Because there was a 2-hour time difference in the phone records between what was shown was the phone call, but it was actually a different time zone. And so the defense counsel, through his client's counsel in State of the Article 32, laid out this timeline or sequence that ultimately proved to be inaccurate. And the government exploited that by saying, well, the alleged victim in this case, she testified based on what her memory was, which in fact turned out to be consistent once you understood what the phone records were saying. But I think at the heart of that, and this goes back to Captain Fox's testimony, at the heart of that, the trial counsel is saying there was deviousness, sinister purpose behind doing this, that the Article 32 did to discredit the alleged victim, the complainant. And it's this attempt to say the defense is manufacturing, fabricating, creating this argument that undermines the entire credibility of the defense case, when in fact, all it was that the defense had misinterpreted what the phone times meant. And even the complaining witness, when she was confused as to when she made certain text messages and phone calls that night, in her own sequence of when the party was over, if you recall, the evidence was that the party ended for all practical purposes at around 11:30. And then she appeared to be testifying that it was almost immediately that Lieutenant Spielman started assaulting her. But in fact, the phone records show that from about 11:30 to 12:15, she was sending text messages to her husband, to Lieutenant Beavis, and she annual making phone calls, and so that any sexual assault could not have even begun until about 45 minutes, until after that point. So you have this situation where both sides had issues with the phone records, but the trial counsel took it beyond what I think is a legitimate argument and turned it into the defense is fabricating a case. They fabricated this case at the Article 32 hearing after they had access to all the discovery and after they took this extended break, then they came up with this fabricated story. When in fact it was simply confusion over the times what the phone records meant.
Is it ever permissible for the government to say the substance of that argument that, look, the accused is simply taking what he or she's heard, you know, throughout this process and weaving facts in to match the story because it is a fabrication? Is it simply the implication that somebody's making up a defense that makes this wrongful? And if that's the case, I'd love to hear your thoughts on what acceptable argument from the government might be. If that case were before you as a prosecutor.
I think that turns the question back to you, Your Honor. It's not a question of what's acceptable. I'm not here to give a speech on what's acceptable argument by trial counsel. What I'm here to say is there is a line. And I think 1050 illustrates the critical point here that I think you're asking about and I want to make clear. Trial counsel at 1050 says, and members, it all makes sense. What does not make sense, what is not corroborated, what is not supported in the evidence, what's a lie, what's a fabrication, what is self-serving is Lieutenant Stone's ever-shaking account of what happened that night. Fletcher said...
Counsel, we're asking you to help us draw that line, though. As you've already agreed during this argument, that it's permissible for a trial counsel to comment on the credibility of any witness, including an accused. So where is that line between commenting on the credibility of a witness, saying their story is simply not credible, and crossing that line into the areas such as Fletcher?
Well, I can only go by Fletcher, and while I will agree, and I'm not sure I've sort of lost track of my time.
I'd be grateful if you finish up your thoughts.
Okay. Fletcher, so I think Fletcher, the prosecutor crossed the line by a wide margin. Now, I'm arguing in this case, by the multiple points where we cite what the trial counsel actually said in his closing argument, we're saying that he crossed the line. Now, exactly where is that line? It's determined on a case-by-case basis. And so, once a prosecutor starts calling an accused a liar, once he starts saying the defense invented a case, fabricated evidence, and essentially used deceit, and that's their defense, and he's attributing that as much to defense counsel as to the accused, I think that crosses the line. I think that's where the line's crossed. Once he starts injecting his personal opinion, and I've cited that, and as well it appears in... Okay, I've got one. I mean, it appears... We cited that in our brief, the multiple places where trial counsel gives his opinion and puts his own belief behind what the complaining witness said. When we take all of those together, and I guess I am arguing a cumulative effect, even if you find no individual statement by the trial counsel cross the line, I think what we have, the clear picture that we have that emerges here, is that the trial counsel, in his closing argument, through the multiple ways in which he disparaged the accused, disparaged trial counsel, rejected his own personal beliefs, the cumulative effect of that clearly crossed the line. So it's as much a cumulative effect argument as it is that any one item is wrong. But what we attempted to do in our brief is to basically, and my time has expired, I'm going to finish.
Please.
What we attempted to do in the brief is point to the court's attention to every place where the trial counsel said something that has in Fletcher and other related cases has been found to be improper argument by trial counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the court. I'm Captain Thomas Albert, along with Mr. Gerald Bruce. We represent the United States in this case. Appellant's conviction and sentence in this case should be upheld for three simple reasons. Number one, the evidence is both factually and legally sufficient. Number two, nothing the trial counsel said in his eloquent closing argument was error or plain error, including the 50 or so excerpts appellant has randomly selected to assert wrongdoing. And number three, if there is some possible way this court finds error in the trial counsel's argument, any error came nowhere close to prejudicing the appellant. With respect to factual and legal sufficiency, although the appellant enhanced the legal sufficiency standard in his brief and in his reply brief, his argument with respect to the first issue is purely factual. But in this case, where much of the verdict rested on the testimony of witnesses, particularly the testimony of the one victim witness, Lieutenant RAP, this court should heed its standard of review and make allowances for not having personally observed the witnesses by deferring to the judgment of the members below who were able to witness her credibility and the credibility of the rest of the witnesses. But that having been said, this court can be very confident that the evidence is legally and factually sufficient, because of a few big points here I'd like to make. Number one, Lieutenant RAP was incredibly consistent. Her testimony begins on page 317 of the record. If you look at her Article 32 testimony, which she does mention in the testimony contained in the record of trial, as well as her testimony in trial, it is consistent, especially with regard to one important factor, and that is the phone records. Initially, at the Article 32 testimony, the phone records, the trial counsel even thought that the phone records were at a particular time. They later discovered that they were off by 2 hours. She maintained that she never called the accused first, that she had received a text message. I'm sorry, he had called her, and then she texted him back. That was reversed at the Article 32, and the trial counsel even confronted her on that, and she still stuck by that story. And then, lo and behold, when the trial came along, that under Prosecution Exhibit 6, that evidence came out to be that she was, in fact, correct, that the accused had called her, and then she text messaged back and said, I don't want you to come over. There was absolutely no motive to fabricate that was presented at trial. There was no hatred or affection for the appellant, no real motive to make this testimony up. And if you look at her testimony, the testimony of what happened, it's a very elaborate and odd occurrence that happened on the 2nd of December of 2011. Something very elaborate for a victim to make up. And when you go back and you look at, well, does this make sense? Is this factually sufficient? I encourage this court then to look at the internet search history of appellant's cell phone, which RAP had no knowledge of. And when they actually went and looked at the terms that he was searching prior to the assault, it matched up exactly with the kind of fetishes that he expressed during the assault. His internet search history contained terms such as facefuck, men dominating women by feet, spank pixies, punish brass, human footstools, that's at a record at 861. And again, all of this search prior to the assault would have been unknown to Lieutenant R.A.P. Now, juxtaposing that with the appellant's story, it was incredibly inconsistent. And the trial counsel, and I'll get to this in a minute, the trial counsel pointed this out repeatedly because he put himself on the line when he made an unsworn statement at the Article 32. And under 801D, the government was allowed to bring in evidence of what he had testified to at the Article 32. But when you compare that to the pretextual phone call that was done by OSI, his stories are completely different. The pretextual phone call, he says, I was drunk, I blacked out, I don't know what happened. He never denies anything that happened. And then at the Article 32 testimony, lo and behold, he remembers every single detail. But it's self-serving, and he basically tries to excuse his conduct.
Counsel, do you see a difference, though, between commenting on differences in testimony, say between the pretext phone call and the Article 32 testimony, and then somehow also the series of questions regarding the appellant's interaction with his defense attorney at the Article 32?
Well, first off, Your Honor, I think I want to point out that the issue that has been framed in this court is improper argument. Granted, you do have to look at that in context of the entire trial, but we're not dealing with was there prosecutorial misconduct in cross-examination or anything like that. But if you look at the trial counsel's statements with respect to the defense attorney, and Mr. Spinner brings this up in his brief, that he's disparaging the defense attorney, you're not going to find a word in the record of trial where he disparages the defense attorney. He says, once, maybe two times, the appellant fabricated a story, not Mr. Waddington. The appellant fabricated a story. Now, that is completely different from going on and saying that somehow that there was a conspiracy between the appellant and his defense counsel to come right out and make something up and to fabricate a story.
Counsel, I want to refer you to page 1062 of the record during trial counsel's arguments, and he says, quote, by Lieutenant Spielman's account, after having reviewed all the evidence and asked questions only by Mr. Waddington here in this courtroom of why he was answering the way he was, and he continues, so doesn't trial counsel, in fact, during the argument, make references to Mr. Waddington and his interaction with his client?
It's
page 1062, lines 13, 14, and 15.
Okay, yeah, by Lieutenant Spielman's account, after having reviewed all the evidence, and that also is tied into the line of argument where he's discussing the Article 32 on page 1060. Now, I think it's particularly important, Your Honor, to point out the fact that he was also given the false exculpatory instruction in this case. So he was simply arguing that the appellant himself fabricated the story. If you look at page 1060, at the Article 32 hearing, represented by counsel, having been given the opportunity to review all those pretext notes from the agents that were apparently weren't great for remembering what happened, but were perfect for fabricating the story, the defense takes a break, et cetera, et cetera. Now, he's arguing there that he didn't say that Mr. Waddington fabricated a story, but that it was an opportunity to fabricate a story. And he's stating mere facts. It is a fact that at the Article 32 hearing, they heard all the evidence come out. Lieutenant R.A.P. testified. They had those phone records. And lo and behold, appellant comes out and says, no, actually, I was responding to her phone call when I contacted her. But he didn't know that the phone records were off. So, of course, trial counsel is going to want to point out that this was a perfect opportunity to fabricate a story. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he was fabricating a story with his defense counsel. His defense counsel could have been completely oblivious to that fact. And I would point you to the record. He does not point to there's nothing that the trial counsel says that disparages Mr. Waddington in the entire argument. And if we could switch to the argument issue,
I want to ask you again about the argument issue with the quote that you just gave and the quote that I gave earlier. So you're saying those two in conjunction do not reference the defense attorney, Mr. Waddington?
The United States would assert no, that they do not. And I think it's equally important, though, Your Honor, in viewing this, and Mr. Spinner pointed this out, this is a plain error analysis. There was not an objection during the 42 pages of trial counsel's argument. There was not a peep from defense counsel. We don't have IAC alleged here. There was not a peep from defense counsel, not objected to once. And this raises an important question. And
Counsel, let me ask you, under plain error analysis, would you agree that it's plain error to comment on an appellant's exercise their constitutional right to remain silent?
I would absolutely agree with that.
Would you agree under plain error analysis that it's plain error to comment on an appellant's right, let's say if they were read their rights by OSI or security forces, to request counsel at that time?
Yes, Your Honor. These are all fact-specific, but universally, yes.
So universally, it's plain error to comment on an accused constitutional rights under the Fifth Amendment, correct?
It is, Your Honor.
Obviously, again, fact-specific, but generally speaking. So why is it not plain error to comment on an accused right under the Sixth Amendment to consult with counsel during a proceeding? Isn't that what trial counsel is doing here, commenting on the accused right to consult with his counsel during the 32 proceeding?
Your Honor, I would just have to disagree factually. The facts do not indicate that. He merely says, he's saying the facts. At the Article 32 testimony, he heard all this evidence, represented by counsel, et cetera, et cetera. He's just listing what was going on. He wasn't saying that there was some kind of nefarious intent there, and maybe I'm not reading it the way you are, but I don't see that he is saying anything or commenting about his right to an attorney. And
so commenting on the fact that he was represented by counsel, commenting on the fact that the defense takes a break, commenting on that he was asked questions only by Mr. Waddington are not comments on his right to consult with counsel. Is that your position?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because those are factual statements, and there's no implication. There's nothing he's following that up with.
Isn't it also a factual statement if someone invokes the right to counsel or invokes the right to remain silent?
It is, Your Honor, but the inference from that when you invoke your right to counsel is that you must be guilty because you're invoking your right to counsel, and the Supreme Court has come down and said you can't draw that inference because of the Fifth Amendment. This is completely different because he's merely saying that he was being questioned by his attorney at trial. There's no inference to be drawn from that. He was saying that he was being asked those questions by his attorney. So, I mean, there may be a logical leap there that you would have to make to say that he was somehow implying a negative inference, but the United States would say that these were all factual things that actually happened in an open forum, unlike when you assert your right to counsel, that's during an interrogation, and that's why it's so important, too, that the Supreme Court has said we don't want that to be discussed at trial, because what goes on in an interrogation could be inherently coercive. Well, you don't have that here. In Article 32, he's questioned by Mr. Waddington. If he were to testify at trial, he'd be questioned by Mr. Waddington. There's no adverse inference to be drawn from that.
So is it your position that it's only a constitutional violation or a potential error if comment about an accused's exercise of his right to counsel happens during the interrogation stage? That is, any time after that, commenting about an accused's desire to confer with counsel before proceeding further, or preparations an accused may have undertaken with the assistance of counsel, all of that's fair comment because it happened outside the interrogation or after that point at which the initial invocation was made?
Well, again, these are all facts, very fact-specific inquiries, but I mean, I think I can imagine a few hypotheticals where if a trial counsel came out right and said to a panel of members, hey, listen, look, he's consulting with his counsel, obviously, or something along those lines. But here he doesn't say that. And we're selectively picking out these quotes out of an argument that should be read in its entire context. And there is no implication when you read this in context that he's hiding something because he's being questioned by his own attorney.
I'll put it in context for you. Situation A, prosecutor says, you know what, he came up with a story that fit the facts after he heard everything, right? Situation B, you know what? He came up with a story that fit the facts after he heard everything and chatted with his lawyer about how best to do it. Is there a distinction between those two?
There may be a distinction if that's how it is phrased. But he phrased it as, if you go back and you look at this quote, represented by counsel, having been given the opportunity to review all those pretext notes from the agents that were apparent, et cetera, takes a break. He's merely just giving a factual account of what happened. He's not then taking the next step and saying, well, we know then that there's a nefarious intent there. He's just saying that there is an opportunity, but we're perfect for fabricating a story. There was an opportunity there, and we know that he did fabricate the story because when he came back, He said, after having seen the phone records, and this was actually continued into trial until defense counsel realized that the phone records were off by 2 hours, that that story was not consistent with the evidence. Now, going back to your standard of review, Your Honor, when there is no objection from the defense counsel, it draws the question, and I know that we have some experience here being trial judges, that at what point is a military judge supposed to know when to stop? If this is just a cumulative impact, if this is just some kind of brooding omnipresence in the sky, when is the military judge supposed to say, okay, now there's just enough going on where I'm supposed to stop this? That's the problem with appellant's argument, is he cannot point to a single thing that where the military judge should have sua sponte stopped. He even acknowledges that. Now, with respect to, he lists these categories of things that were disparaging, that were said by the trial counsel, disparaging defense counsel, and as Judge Mitchell correctly pointed out, that the big lie that was promised, he was referring to defense counsel. If you look at defense counsel's opening statement, he talks about how RAP has these lies that she sold, 3 stories that she's told, 10 stories, and then the trial counsel rebuts that by saying, 3 stories, 10 stories, no, what those big lies that were promised were never delivered by the defense counsel. And that is, once the defense counsel puts himself out there and makes those promises, it is fair game for the trial counsel to come back and to rebut that. Now, with respect to disparaging the accused, I want to point out that trial counsel never calls the accused a liar. There are a handful of times where he refers to his lies, but appellant himself stated in his Article 32 unsworn statement that he had lied in the pretext phone call. In fact, the trial counsel, while we're looking at these selective quotes that appellant has pointed out, I would ask this court to look at some quotes that I'm about to point out where the trial counsel credits the appellant. So, trial counsel says during his closing argument on record page 1051, during the assault or before, appellant was a great guy. I will not stand up here and say anything other than it appears he's an incredible. He has incredible service and incredible opportunities afforded to him by the taxpayers and by the United States Air Force, and he's earned every one of them. With regard to RAP's reaction during the assault, that she reacted a certain way, and quote, because of who Lieutenant Spielman is and the support he has in the squadron and how he's recognized as having good military character and how he doesn't mistreat women and how he is generally peaceable. That's at page 1033. At page 1067, it's entirely possible that Lieutenant Spielman is that guy. He's this great guy, and he just made a mistake. It's hard to believe Lieutenant Spielman did these things. That's 1067. And then with respect to the text messages, trial counsel says, well, we can give him the benefit of the doubt on this first text message. That's 1054. And then at 1065, what happened on the 2nd of December isn't what we expect Lieutenant Spielman to be. Now, reviewing whether his statements are lies or not, in a handful of comments that are lies, when you look at the appellate court cases that deal with, that it's frowned upon, it's not per se error, but it's frowned upon to call appellant a liar, in each one of those cases, appellant testifies. Like in Fletcher, for example, appellant testifies. And the disparaging comments of the accused and his counsel that rise to the level of error are when he says he's suborning perjury, that the defense counsel is obviously making his client lie, and the client is lying there. He has no basis to assert that in Fletcher because, I'm sorry, she, I believe it was a she, had no basis to assert that in Fletcher because she's just saying that the testimony doesn't agree with the evidence that the government has. Well, this is different. He never testified in this case. And here, we have 2 inconsistent statements made by the accused, so it's perfectly reasonable for the trial counsel to get up and say that this was a lie that he fabricated. This is argument. This is our adversarial system.
What is the government's position as to the applicability of the invited reply doctrine? Does that apply in this case, and what comments or questions by defense counsel invoke that doctrine in this case?
I think I mentioned, Judge Weber, the opening statement at the very least, and then once RAP's motive was challenged, that he could comment on. Well, first off, let me take a step back. In the opening statement, defense counsel made this case entirely about credibility. So there's this juxtaposition of RAP versus the appellant that the trial counsel was obligated to address in his closing argument in order to be effective. So I think The opening statement, if you read that opening statement, it's fairly lengthy for an opening statement. I think there is invited discussion there that the defense counsel invites when he brings up these different stories, when he brings up the fact that credibility is the main issue. This is especially in light of the false exculpatory instruction, where it says that you may infer that an innocent person does not ordinarily find it necessary to invent or fabricate a voluntary explanation or statement tending to establish his innocence. He got that instruction, and trial counsel was effectively arguing that instruction. And even in that instruction, it has the word fabricate. So this is not something where it's per se rule where you can't talk about fabrication on behalf of the appellant, because that would tie the hands of a trial counsel in trying to argue, especially where credibility is paramount, trying to argue that this person is credible and this person is not.
I recognize that you're arguing that trial counsel did not make any improper arguments. Assuming that the doctrine applies here and that defense counsel sort of opened the door to some sort of otherwise improper comments by trial counsel, how far does that doctrine go? Courts have expressed a concern from time to time that the doctrine would swallow the general rule against improper comments. If, for example, defense counsel placed credibility at issue here and invited some otherwise improper comments on the credibility or fabrication of the defense theory, how far does that allow trial counsel to go?
Well, I think the line isn't clear in the appellate court cases that deal with this, Your Honor, but I think we can be confident that 403 still applies. And then it's something this court cannot just disregard is the fact that there is a defense counsel sitting there with the appellant. If he thought this was going too far, the onus was on him to object. And nothing went to the level of plain error. Even if you think that there was some error lingering here in a few of the comments, nothing went to the level of plain error that would then trigger the sua sponte duty by the military judge to correct it. So I think, to answer your question, I think 403 would still apply, but the military judge was still sitting there, presumably awake and listening to this testimony, and never felt the need to stop the trial counsel. The defense counsel also talks about some improper vouching. But trial counsel, again, to discuss some quotes from his closing argument, made clear in his opinion that his argument and defense counsel's argument were just that, arguments. Trial counsel says at 1066, the law beyond that recognizes that you, not me, not Mr. Waddington, not Captain Doherty, not Captain Morgan, you, the members, by reason of your age, temperament, and experience, are the ones qualified to make these determinations, credibility determinations. You're the ones who say what the evidence is. You're the ones who take inferences or leave them if you don't find them persuasive. It is you, and it's common sense. Then on page 1030, you're going to make your own determinations of the evidence, members. 1031, who knows how long Mr. Waddington will talk, but at the end of the day, what the lawyers say is not evidence. Again, this is not the military judge. This is trial counsel. He also says, I'm not going to tell you what you perceive RAP's credibility to be. You have your own perception. People, but I would implore you, I would challenge you to see any lies, trickery, or deceit. That's at 1038. So, trial counsel's argument was eminently reasonable, and I asked this court to read it in its entirety, along with defense counsel's opening statement, as I mentioned, as well as their closing argument. And when you do that, it should be absolutely clear under Fletcher, under Clifton, etc., that this assignment of error has no merit. And when looking at this just overarching cumulative error doctrine, the government would assert that 0 plus 0 equals 0, that you can't just say, well, all of this together had this mosaic effect, when you can't point to single errors, because there has to be a number of errors to equal cumulative errors. So if you don't have any, the end result is 0.
As to the improper vouching, is it your position that the references, the half dozen or so references, the first person pronoun, I think it's clear, I'm telling you, I have no doubt, at least by my perception, I think it is, I don't think, and so on and so forth. Those are errors, but they're not prejudicial.
Well, this is where I think Fletcher, Your Honor, kind of muddied the waters a bit, because Fletcher doesn't say any individual, I or me or we, is an error, because those sorts of things just happen because we're human beings.
Right. I get that it's not talismanic.
Yeah. I think that there's a certain threshold. I think in Fletcher it was over 24 times, and the person kept saying, I think, this is the way it is. This is I think after a certain point, then, yes, that rises to the level of error if it continues. And in Fletcher, remember, there were objections going on, not at all the argument, but in the argument where the military judge could then correct it, but then trial counsel would go on to do that. And that's the same with this recent CAF case of U.S. v. Hornbeck, where trial counsel just ignored the instructions of the military judge. Well, you don't have that here. And a trial counsel invariably is going to use the personal pronoun. But that itself is not something that this court should then say, okay, well, this is an improper argument because it just happens all the time, frankly.
So back to the question, in context, these were not error.
That's correct, Your Honor. As stated in the United States' brief, it is understandable that the defense counsel would desire to deprive the government of its ability to make a closing argument entirely, since that could tip the balance of the trial in his favor. But as stated before, the trial counsel is allowed and encouraged in our adversarial system to strike fair but not foul blows, and to provide the fact finder with an argument based on the evidence of record, as well as all reasonable inferences derived from that evidence. Trial counsel did so here quite effectively. There was no error. There was no prejudice. The evidence was and is sufficient. Appellant's convictions and well-deserved sentence should therefore stand. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
First of all, I'd like to go back to the question which the court asked government counsel, and where I guess I disagree with his response. It has to do with the disparagement of defense counsel. And I would bring the court's attention to, and we recite this in our brief, on page 1037 of the record. Trial counsel argues, but it's stronger evidence than that, members, because we know from the defense's cross-examination of Lieutenant Payne that the Article 32 of the government was tabled, and the same defense counsel at that table didn't understand the graphics. So I think that's an illustration of disparaging defense counsel. And then on the very next page, at 1038, he's talking about the evidence, and he says, you can take that to the bank, that is solid as a dollar, that is good. For her to hold to that with everybody else, the brilliant lawyers who are scouring over this, trying to make legal arguments, are confused about. So, and I mean, one of the problems, we're just reading black and white on the page, but I don't think there's any question that trial counsel did not think they were brilliant lawyers. He was being sarcastic at this point and he's maligning defense counsel because he's basically saying, they don't get it, but I do.
Aren't trial counsel implicated in that statement as well, because they were scouring over the same records and questioning her about the same matter?
The focus I'm making here, sir, is just that the term brilliant lawyers, it's not so much a scouring over the record, but it comes right after what he just said about the defense lawyers not understanding the records. Whether the defense attorneys understand the records or not is not relevant to finding facts or assessing credibility. It's not if the lawyers are smart, it's not if the lawyers are brilliant, it's not if the defense attorneys are dumb. But by making that a point here, that is clearly a disparaging remark. That's all I'm arguing. And it really comes back to, in the rebuttal, and whenever I look at plain error, when I look at presenting issues to this court and looking for prejudice, I think an important point is at the beginning of an argument and at the rebuttal stage. And the trial counsel comes back up to make his final rebuttal speaking, the defense counsel arguments. At page 1125 in the record, and this is where really it goes beyond just I think this, I think this, I believe this, or I don't believe this, the trial counsel using I. The trial counsel is also trying to identify himself and put the weight and credibility of the United States government behind what he has argued. And so on page 1125 in the record, at lines 13 through 17, or 16, trial counsel argues this should rise and fall with Lieutenant RP, and it should rise and fall if you take my advice with Lieutenant Timothy Spillman. It's a simple question when you go back there if you understand it as the United States does. So he's not, well, here now he's saying, I represent the United States. The United States knows what really happened here. We're telling you that Lieutenant R.A.P. is credible, is 100%, you can take it to the bank, and Lieutenant Spillman's totally incredible, incredible, unbelievable, if you see this as the United States does. And so I would maintain that when this court, and I believe the court will get past the point of saying, was there improper argument here? I think the court will find that. Now we're assessing, okay, where's the prejudice? And I submit, we find the prejudice right there in the rebuttal argument where the trial counsel now is explicitly invoking the United States to support his case. Now, with respect to when does the judge sua sponte intervene, I'd like to comment on that. The trial counsel, I believe, misstated the instruction on the false inculpatory testimony. And there was a point where the trial counsel, where they make reference to the military judge's instruction. Now, page 1066 in the record, trial counsel argues, the law recognizes the military judge has instructed me, Captain Morgan alluded to, but I can just recognize as well, innocent people don't find it necessary to lie. That's not the judge's instruction. And the judge, in the judge's instruction, which is found at page 1021 in the record, and I'm not going to read the instruction to you, but it says you may infer that an innocent person does not go to matter to find it necessary. The drawing of this inference is not required. Now, it is certainly something that can be argued, especially going to consciousness of guilt or something of that sort. But the judge, in my humble opinion, should have sua sponte intervened. There were two points in the closing argument where the trial counsel made this argument. But that's not the instruction. The military judge instructed you, innocent people don't find it necessary to lie. That wasn't the instruction. It goes much farther than that. And the trial counsel and the judge should have intervened and given. And as we've seen, all of us have seen, as you, I believe you will, if you're talking about this, talk very specifically, whenever they hear the military judge invoke you by name or as the military judge and the trial counsel spoken on, or the defense counsel spoken on, either way, when we start talking about instructions, I know almost every judge I've been in front of is quick to jump in without a defense counsel objection and say, I give the instruction for this case. You have an instruction on this point. Can the members follow the instruction that I gave you, or words to that effect? And that did not happen here. One
other point. Counsel, didn't the military judge, though, give the standard instructions that if there's any disparity, I'm going to paraphrase it here, but essentially, if there's any disparity between what counsel said about the instructions and my instructions, you must accept my word as binding.
Right.
And doesn't that cure that problem then?
I would say it does not, Your Honor, because it's at the point that, first of all, you have this lengthy argument. And I, quite frankly, if the judge may have already given his instructions at this point, so members are having to remember a judge's instruction either at the beginning of closing arguments or after both sides have completed closing arguments. But when the judge doesn't intervene at the point that the instruction is misrepresented by either advocate, then the members may not pick up the connection between that point and the argument and whenever the judge gave the instruction. I'm just not convinced the members are able to connect those dots in every instance. So I would argue in this instance that that would not be curative.
If I might, this is a follow-up to Judge Mitchell's question on instructions and your argument sort of about aggregate and what we should consider in the aggregate. And government counsel's comments about, I think you phrased it, that 0 plus 0 still equals 0. But by my count, I'm looking at pages 17 and 18 of your assignment of error. 11 of the 17 or 18 comments there that you argue are improper reference some use of the word sense, common sense, makes sense, doesn't make sense, doesn't really make sense. I know before, I had asked you, for some examples of what's okay to say and what's not okay to say. I'm curious for your sense here. A, doesn't the judge tell the members to use your common sense and knowledge of the ways of the world when evaluating credibility of witnesses?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think our focus is more, while we gave those quotes, I think our strongest points relate to where this is 100% credible when you look at the prosecution of the complaining witness, and it's totally unbelievable when you look at what the accused said.
But as to this statement, it makes absolute sense. Standing alone, surgically extracted, is that offensive?
Yes. Standing alone.
You mean that, right?
Isolated. I don't know that I can say that's an improper argument. But that's why, and I think both sides accuse each other of cherry picking from this 1,000-page record of trial. Certainly that goes on when you're trying to write a brief. And that's why ultimately our appeal to the court is read the entire argument. And obviously, you can grade the different statements that are said. I understand that some scholars have gone through the Bible and actually tried to identify which were the real remarks of Jesus and which ones weren't. The defense position is that there are enough statements by trial counsel once you go through the record, and my time is up if I may finish my sentence.
Please.
When you go through the record, and eliminate whatever you will, such as that type of statement, what is left still crosses the line, and the cumulative impact of that prejudice the economy in this case.
Okay. Thank you very much. I want to thank both sides for your thoughtful preparation and probing and insightful arguments. We will take this matter up and render a decision in due course. Court is adjourned.
All right.